Hi, this is Andrew, and this is Keen On, the daily now.tv chat show with some of the world's leading thinkers and writers. Hello, everybody. It is spring in San Francisco, where I always broadcast from, although, of course, in San Francisco, spring means different things to different people. It has become associated, this West Coast city, with homelessness. We did a show last month with Kevin Adler, a local homeless activist. He has an important new book out, When We Walk By, Forgotten Humanity, Broken Systems, and the Role We Can Each Play in Ending Homelessness in America. We've done many shows on homelessness in California. Next week, I've actually got Dale Maharidge, who's a Pulitzer Prize writer and a Columbia University professor, coming on the show to talk about what he calls in his new collection, American Doom Loop, Dispatches from a Troubled Nation. And for Maharidge, homelessness is the heart of the crisis of the doom loop. My two guests today are also very interested in what Maharidge calls the doom loop in homelessness and the crisis, not just of homelessness, but of underhousing. There's a new collection out. It's called Housing the Nation, Social Equity, Architecture, and the Future of Affordable Housing. It's co-edited by my two guests, Victoria Newhouse and Alexander Gorlin. Alexander Gorlin is an architect. Victoria Newhouse has always been particularly interested in this subject, and they're both joining us from New York City. Let's start with you, Victoria. How central is the crisis of homelessness to the many of the problems in America today, in your view?
Oh, I think it's absolutely central. First of all, homelessness in America is no longer limited to big cities as it began. It's now everywhere, and even in rural communities. In fact, one of the articles in our book is written by architects who work in Alabama and who are doing a magnificent job of showing people how they can construct housing for themselves less expensively than they have been used to. So I think that this is one of the central problems in the United States today, and many of the problems that we're facing that are peripheral to homelessness, like drug addiction, alcoholism, depression, etc., stem from homelessness.
And is the inequality of the American capitalism of the 2020s, is that behind the crisis of homelessness?
Well, of course. I mean, the Black population suffers much more extensively from all of these problems, homelessness, problems with getting insurance when their homes are damaged in catastrophes like hurricanes and floods and so forth. The Black population always suffers and gets less than a white population would receive. Racial problems, racial inequality is a deep problem in all of this. And in fact, several of the articles in our book address this problem.
Let's bring Alexander in. Many people will associate his name with one of the most distinguished architectural firms, certainly in New York City, Alexander Gorlin Architects. For you, Alexander, you're a builder of homes. You don't destroy homes. So for you as an architect, what does this crisis mean?
Well, it's about creating homes for people who are in need. And related to homelessness, in fact, I've worked with Roseanne Haggerty, who has an article in the book, and was the founder of Common Ground. That was one of the pioneering groups in support of housing to take people who are formerly homeless and give them places to live with social services to help them get back on their feet with job placement and social workers. So we've built a number of supportive housing facilities that really help solve the homeless problem incrementally.
Alexander, what is the problem? Is the problem that there isn't enough housing? There's so much debate about it, for example, in San Francisco, and I know in New York, about empty homes and homeless people or poor people or people who can't afford rents not having access to them. Is the core problem that there aren't enough homes, or is the core problem that many people simply can't afford, certainly not to buy, of course, but also even to rent?
Well, I think the book is really shows that it's a multi-layered problem that includes not enough stock of homes that people can afford, and also for homeless people, not having the access to homes, and also the change in laws, which means that, I mean, many years ago, many of the institutions no longer kept people incarcerated, but on the other hand, they didn't provide, you know, the means to help them, you know, get jobs and get back on their feet, really.
And how do you quantify it? I mean, there's lots, I've read a lot, and we've had a lot of conversations on the show about overcrowding in housing, about families stacking up together. Is that part of the analysis of your book, of people sharing, of families sharing bedrooms?
That's not really what the book focuses on. I mean, it's providing, I mean, that's, for example, a corollary of the New York City Housing Authority, in which generations of families have lived in the same apartment, and people do share they share apartments as opposed to having their own places to live.
Let's bring Victoria back. Victoria, tell me the background to the book. I know you co-authored a piece with Alexander that triggered this book.
Well, we tried to make a book that is holistic, that really includes many, many of the issues related to affordable housing. I mean, everybody knows that there is a problem in the United States. There's a problem worldwide, but we were focusing specifically on the United States. So we felt that it was pointless to just repeat that. And what we tried to do is to fill in a lot of the issues, like racism, like zoning, like city planning, that are related to homelessness and to affordable housing, so that people can better understand the whole problem. We organized a roundtable discussion on Monday night at the New York Historical Society. There were over 400 people there. It was sold out. And dozens of people came up to Alex and me afterwards and said that they were absolutely amazed at what they learned. They had no idea of the extent of the problem and the issues involved.
Do you think that's because partly of the divisions in this country? I don't know the socioeconomic status of the audience you had in Manhattan, but I'm guessing probably people like you and Alex, people who are very successful, beautiful homes. Do you think that the elites in this country, particularly the coastal elites, are profoundly unaware of how most people in this country live?
I think they're not only unaware, but I think they're selfish and bigoted. Well, I think that when a suburban community refuses to allow affordable housing to be built in their neighborhood, it shows a terrible disregard for human issues.
Let's bring Alex back in. Alex, you're a busy guy. You very well-known architect. Why did you throw your hat into this ring? Why did you choose to co-edit?
Well, I actually started
homelessness.
Well, I mean, I started my career doing houses for well-to-do people, and after a while, I felt it was not. I should really expand my talents to help you know, a larger population of people in need. And so I really sought after the projects that are affordable and also helping the formerly homeless. So it's really part of the purpose of the book is to make people aware, especially architects, so that more architects will use their abilities to help build affordable housing.
Your firm, Gorlin, is behind some low cost, I don't know if that's the right word, equity housing, one that I read about, El Borinquen. Tell me a little bit about this and why this is the kind of project that you would like other architects to also pursue.
Well, this was built for a nonprofit developer and also social service provider, Communalife.
Whereabouts?
It's in the South Bronx. And it was set up by Dr. Rosa Gill, who is a psychiatrist who wrote about the problems of Hispanic people and how they can culturally relate to the West. And she especially has a program called Life is Precious to help prevent Latina suicides, which unfortunately is a very prevalent problem in that community. So the purpose of this housing is not only to provide affordable housing, but provide a platform for the social services that Communalife provides. And in this case, it's for the neighboring Latin community in the South Bronx. And so it's named after the original indigenous name of Puerto Rico, which is El Borinquen.
You do very high profile work. I was just looking around. One of your projects was the UN Plaza apartment, which I assume you were very well compensated for. Is this for you? And for other architects, this low-cost architecture, is it a non-profit endeavor, or would you charge the same as you would for the UN program?
No, the fees are lower, although they're not bad. And there is somewhat of a sacrifice to do this work, but it's very important work that needs to be done.
So. Let's bring Victoria back in. Victoria, you've spent your life with an interest in housing. Are there not enough architects like Alex who are committed to building low-cost housing? Is that, in your view, one of the biggest problems?
Well, I wouldn't call it one of the biggest problems, but I think Alex is very special in that he pursues projects aggressively. This kind of project, which many, many architects just will not take the time or make the effort to do.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, the design, I think one of the issues is that even when there was affordable housing being built in this country at a larger scale, the design aspect was not considered important. In fact, it was considered like dressing on the cake. So what has happened in, you know, since, let's say, 2000, is that there's more of a awareness that design will elevate the nature of, you know, the wellness and health of the people living in these buildings, and that it doesn't necessarily cost more. It's simply being creative with the budget and tools that the architect has.
Alex, is a historical analysis valuable here? Of course, there was a fashion for prefabricated buildings in the depths of the Great Recession in the 1930s. We're not back in the Great Recession or the Great Depression, but things are very tough for many Americans.
Right.
What can we learn from history?
Well, we've actually done prefabricated housing in Brooklyn, and I think all of these techniques are important to the period in which the housing is being built. So, for example, right now there's an interest in mass timber as another way of construction, or containers, or also prefabrication, or 3D printing as a means of providing low-cost housing. So In each period, there are different techniques and materials that are appropriate, to the budget of that time.
We are speaking with the two editors of an important new book, Housing the Nation, Alexander Gorlin and Victoria Newhouse, an important book and an important subject. I want to thank our friends at Liberties, a quarterly journal of culture and politics, for bringing us this kind of discussion. I'm going to run a short feature about Liberties, and then we'll be back with Victoria and Alex to talk more specifically about this collection of essays and which ones, in their view, are the most important. So we'll be back in a second. Don't go away, anyone.
Oh. News, the noise, there is nuance, insight. Liberties is not just a journal of ideas. It's a meteor of intelligent substance. It's the place to be for engaged citizens. Politics, opinion, substance. Liberties is a triumph for freedom of thought. A quarterly of urgency, of cultural exploration, of intellectual delight, of immaculate prose. It's invaluable. Subscribe now or find Liberties at your favorite bookseller.
And you can subscribe to Liberties at libertiesjournal.com. We are speaking with our two guests today, Victoria Newhouse and Alexander Gorlin, who have co-edited an important collection of essays about our housing crisis in the United States, Housing the Nation. Victoria, let me bring you back. I don't want you to choose between your children, but this essay is full of this collection is full of many essays. Is what, 20 or 30 essays? If you had to pick one or two of them, at least to talk about today, which to you really resonate?
Well, I think they're all really extremely intelligent and revealing of different aspects of the whole situation. I really couldn't single out one. I think that David Trout, who is an African American lawyer who teaches in Newark, New Jersey, I think that his essay is particularly revealing about the plight of underprivileged Black people in this country.
And tell me more. What does he say?
Well, he's saying that Black people expect to be cheated, to put it bluntly, that people who own real estate in Newark, he's particularly knowledgeable about Newark, they expect to be offered less money for what they are selling than a white person would be. And he describes how big time investment firms come into Newark and buy up property from, in many cases, from African Americans, give them less than they would pay if the owners were white, and then simply use these properties to make money for themselves. They don't turn them over to people who can afford them. On the contrary, they spruce them up and resell them and make money for themselves.
Rather like the behavior of Trump's father as a landlord. I think he was investigated for that. That's illegal, though, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. It's better than Trump's grandfather who built brothels.
So you like the piece by David Dante Trout. Alex? Perhaps, I mean, I'm not suggesting that you discriminate with this collection, but perhaps you might note a couple of the essays that for you personally really resonate.
I think two of the essays are by people I've worked with directly. One of which is Mike Geekin. He wrote the Affordable Housing Forgotten Factors, and he's a community organizer for the Metro IAF and was in fact one of Obama's teachers in Chicago about how to organize communities to gain power so that they can build housing and and move governments and politicians to do what they what is helpful to them. And he goes into detail in his essay about how that's done. So at one level, for example, whenever people talk about NIMBYism or not in my backyard, to me that also indicates that they haven't organized properly, you know, and created a basis for support in the community for these projects. So, and I've built a work with him in Brooklyn for the Nehemiah company, which is for first-time home buyers, and it was all prefab housing. And, you know, so I think he's really a remarkable person. And in that essay, he goes into detail about how he achieved building housing around the United States.
And Alex, go ahead. Well, before you get your other choice, and Victoria, perhaps you can jump in here too. Given how important housing is to so many millions of Americans, why does it never seem to be a major political issue, at least when it comes to the elections? In the election this year,
there's
going to be all sorts of shouting and screaming about immigration and foreign policy and inflation. But I'm very skeptical that housing and homelessness will come up at all.
Well, President Biden did mention housing in his the speech he gave right after his State of the Union. So there is hope. And we tried to encourage each one of these authors to end their essay on a note of hope. And if you're choosing among the different authors, I'd like to mention Roseanne Haggerty, who really has come up with some of the most successful solutions to the whole housing problem. And really, in a very, very, to paraphrase what she does very simply, she gets people to work together in communities. I mean, a lot of the problems today are simply too many different groups working at cross purposes and not coordinating with each other. And Alex can tell you more about this. He's very close to Roseanne.
So Alex, perhaps you might, before you tell us about Roseanne, I know you had another piece that you particularly wanted to talk about.
Actually it was Roseanne. But I totally agree with you. I think it's always shocking to me why, you know, affordable housing is not a bigger issue. But part of the reason is the federal government used to build housing. And in fact, in Europe, in the great housing in the Netherlands and France and Germany was built by the government or through neighborhood organizations funded by the government. And here in this country, that would be considered socialism. So there's always this kind of coming away from that. And in fact, there was the Faircloth Amendment, which limited the number of affordable housing that the government could fund.
I mean, some Americans might argue, Alex, that the market is a more effective mechanism. They might point to Levittown, which I'm sure you're all too familiar with, which also is a checkered story, given its somewhat overt racism. Can the market work, leaving aside government, or do we really need government central in rebuilding America's housing?
Well, I think the government can help in different ways. I mean, right now it does help in terms of tax credits. It's not direct funding, but tax, you know, these financial instruments that allow housing to be built. But it's doled out in a very slow manner. I think private, you know, much of what's done now is a public-private partnership between these nonprofits and the government to build the housing.
And does that work, in your view, thinking of your architect's cap on?
It works, but very slowly, unfortunately. So that's where the stock of housing is not meeting the need as fast as it should be.
We have an essay by a developer, in fact, by a for-profit developer, John McMillan, and he explains how it costs exactly the same amount of money to build affordable housing as it does market rate housing. Right. So someone has to come in and make up the difference that will make it possible to rent those homes or to sell them for less money.
Right. Was there a golden age in your view, one of you, in American housing? Can we look back to a moment, Levittown, the Great Depression, the 1960s, when the government did a much better job on housing?
Well, I think in the 1930s, there was a great deal of, that's when the New York City Housing Authority was established, 1937. And there was a tremendous amount of housing built at that time, and the intentions were very high in terms of design and construction, but then it slowly stopped really. So I think the 30s was a good time.
But wasn't New York under Mayor Koch a time when a lot of affordable housing was built, Alex?
That was a very upbeat. Yes, actually, that's the time of, I believe, the Twin Parks housing in UDC.
Yeah, in the 70s.
In the 70s, yes. So yeah. That was another.
Victoria, what about the generational quality here? One of the essays is by Richard Florida, who has been on the show before, of course, the author of The Creative Class.
Yeah.
Is there a generational quality to this crisis?
I don't quite understand how you relate generations to...
Well, young people now coming onto the job market, leaving college, leaving school, and having to go back to live with their parents and having different expectations and desires.
I don't know. I think Alex can answer better than I can.
Well, hardly of a younger generation anymore, but... I think, in fact, that's one of the comments that Philip Thompson mentions, that, you know, within the Black community, this was always a problem. But now that it's touched the middle class and white communities around the country and the younger people, that it's all of a sudden become a crisis, really. So, yes, this generation is now acutely aware of not being able to afford to live in the cities that their parents did or where they choose to live unless they have jobs in the tech sector or financial departments.
So, right, and we had a show last week about kids who aren't growing up going back to live with their parents.
Right.
But in a world of loneliness and isolation and fragmentation where some people see social media as being very damaging, is it altogether a bad thing, Alex, for kids in their 20s and even 30s to be going back to live with their parents?
Well, that's Italy, isn't it? So it depends on the family. I think that's the difference, really.
I don't know if it's so easy if you're married and want to have a family of your own, if it's so easy to cope with your parents.
Yeah, I don't think anyone wants to live with their parents. Victoria, you're from a very distinguished, very wealthy American family. One of, if there's such a thing as an American aristocracy, you're an aristocrat. Do you think that the super wealthy in this country should be careful about owning more than one house? Do you think that there needs to be, if you like, a kind of cultural reevaluation of how the wealthy live in this country, given this housing crisis?
Well, I think the wealthy have a right to live the way they want to. I mean, anybody who wants to take on the headache of owning more than one residence is welcome to welcome to jump in.
Alex, how do you feel about that?
Well, I don't think that's the heart of the problem. That although actually that is part of what Dean Baker talks about, that the wealthy taking up more land has created a scarcity of, which has raised the prices of areas that were previously affordable.
How does it impact, in your view, one of you, on democracy? Of course, America was founded on egalitarian principles. Tocqueville came here in the 19th century, was impressed with that. So is the foundations of democracy. Is there a connection between what many see as the crisis of democracy in America and the crisis of housing? Is it a return to both political and feudalism and the kind of the space or the lack of space of feudalism?
Well, to some degree, you might say that. I mean, I think that's a very big economic issue and sociological question. I think it's connected, but I don't know exactly. I can't quite trace exactly how to do that since I'm not an economist. But I mean, there is something to be said to the extreme wealth in areas like Palm Beach and the Hamptons, and how that's drawn, income, away from the larger population, I would say.
So, well, several of the economists, like Florida, for example, who write for the book, have discussed the tremendous inequality in this country at this time between rich and poor. I don't think the differences in wealth have ever been as sharply drawn as they are now.
And of course, the disappearance of public space. For you as an architect.
No public space.
Alex, is that another impediment to decent housing?
Yes. Well, I mean, actually, a lot of housing was built in New York when the city owned a lot of land that had been foreclosed during the crisis in the 70s. But then they kind of frittered it away and didn't really build enough housing. But public spaces has become an enormous issue as well in this crisis, which is, I mean, you can point to this idea of like reclaiming the street in Manhattan rather than creating more parks. I mean, when you think back to the 19th century of how like 800 acres was devoted to Central Park, it's unheard of. It would be unheard of now to do something like that, to set aside that level of public space to the city.
Yeah, and of course, Central Park and Golden Gate Park in San
Francisco. Yes, Golden Gate Park, exactly.
Yeah, built by the same. Same person.
Olmsted, right.
So let's end with on a positive note. It's an important new collection. I strongly suggest people pick it up, particularly, of course, if you're interested in the housing crisis in America. It's co-edited by Alexander Gorlin and Victoria Newhouse. Housing the Nation, Social Equity, Architecture, and the Future of Affordable Housing. Let's end on a positive note. For each of you, one thing that you'd like to see done that's doable in the next year or two that can begin to address this crisis.
Well, I think the funding has to be opened up, and there's often grand pronouncements from politicians about various initiatives to build housing, but the funding is often lacking. So I think to actually put their money where their mouth is.
More money. And what about for you, Victoria?
Well, we took on the project of writing this book in the hope that it would encourage changes. And we're hoping to get it into the hands of policymakers and government officials who could make a difference. And so that's really what we hope for the book.